Okay, friends, let us continue. Well, we'll just call it Identification 2. Second program, Unknown. How many programs there will be or what subjects will be covered, but this is my little attempt to deal with essential matters. Well, perhaps I shouldn't call them matters at all, just essentials. And I do this because occasionally I get inspired by the will to understand these things more deeply and to reveal them as much as may be possible. We spoke of these six stanzas, these six trumpeted words, the notes of which, the symbols of which, the words of which could not be revealed by decay, but the meaning of which could somewhat be revealed. Excuse me. The very first sentence, God is. The Lord for A stands firm. Being exists alone. Naught else is. Alice Bailey or whoever edited this went to the effort to make the word is very substantial. Matter of fact, I think what I'd like to do somehow, don't know if I can do that. Let's see, Control B. Yeah, good. Make these words bold. Though not so much the red, which is already bolded. God is the Lord, for A stands firm. Being exists alone, naught else is. Well, I think in this case, we are dealing with God not as a deity who is the creator in action, per se, but he is the one ultimate reality, utterly irreducible, without beginning or end, which is the reason that the words for A are found here. This is not any god such as a solar logos or cosmic logos or one about whom naught may be said or even galactic logos and beyond. This is not even what I would call the ultimate universal logos, although each of these beings must be inseparable from the god here referred to. This God has to be the absolute reality, the one without a second, the one than which there is none other. It is the raw fact of beingness. There is, we can't really call it something, but it's hard in language to avoid calling it something. It's no thing. But there is an identifiable, an infinite identifiable, an utterly infinite identifiable, which simply, forever, is. It is the ultimate assertion of the fact of God, the fact of being. Although it is a non-specific being containing the utterly infinite potential of all special instances of being, this God is. never having been created, never undergoing dissolution, throughout eternal duration. It is the great and only fact. The word Lord is used here, the word God is used here, but we are subject to the limitations of words. It means that than which there can be none higher, none more real, none more essential, none more irreducible. So we use these lofty terms that are applied to many lesser states to refer to this absolute being. Some like to think of it as the essence of being or be-ness, but sometimes that differentiation is not made and it is simply considered to be ultimate being. The Lord for A, forever, stands firm without any possible second or other to influence it. For lack of firmness is always caused by some intrusion of one upon another, or some fallibility within a given structure, that fallibility being caused by multiplicity. And in this being, there is no essential multiplicity, though all multiplicity is generated from it, generated or emanated. Somehow, the one becomes the many, and the only becomes the every. The Lord for A stands firm exactly as it has been forever. That word forever can break most of the circuits of the mind if one is not careful, or perhaps one simply should not be careful, because those are conventional circuits of the mind which need to be broken. The Lord for A stands firm. Being exists alone. It is the ultimate in isolated unity. It is utterly isolated from any produced, emanated aspect of itself. There is none other than it. Forever and ever, always so, ever so, only being, whatever it is, exists. And of course, we need to experience the nature of being so we can have some insight into the meaning given here, that it alone exists. Now, the levels of being which are experienceable are certainly not the same for all consciousnesses. The consciousnesses are limited by their scope and their depth and their degree of immersion in the forms of Mula Prakriti, which is the one undifferentiated object. Being, I think, cannot even be experienced in its utter essentiality by the Universal Logos, who is, I think, a limited instantiation of pure being. Granted, it is the height of all beings in our cosmos. This cosmos is simply an expression of this one being. But that instantiation of pure being, which we call the universal logos, you can call it anything you like, is infinitely limited. It's a one compared to the infinity of all infinities, the absolute, undifferentiable or undifferentiated infinity. So when we say being exists alone, we're not talking about the being who is the universal logos. We're talking about that of which it is an instantiation. I like that word, an instance of. My son, Matthew, who studies philosophy, uses that word, and it's part of the philosophical language. And I thought, okay, this is a good one to borrow. This is a good word. Because all, you know, in the statement of the nature of harmlessness, we are told that there is one infinite being, and that all the various beings are externalizations of it. Externalization, instantiation. These are good words to point to the relativity and impermanence of all beings who derive from the irreducible, the ultimately irreducible. The universal logos, the greatest of all present beings, is reducible, although in essence not. But its limitation, and it is limited, I believe, its limitation is reducible, so that it makes its transition back into the irreducible, the one being who exists alone, and naught else is. It, in fact, this one being is the naught. It's the zero as opposed to number. It is, in a way, infinitely removed from all specifiable number or numbers. It is the great all-containing void, the utter plenum, which in essence is non-multiple, but in expression is infinitely multiple. God is, just that fact, that's the ultimate reassurance, isn't it? God is almost equivalent, well, it is equivalent to I am. Not any tiny, specifiable I, but the I that is the essence of all mistaken identities who find themselves identifying with the ring past knot, which limits their consciousness, but not forever. God is and I am are equivalent. Of course, there are maybe very few in the world who want one to identify as God. But even as far back as old Atlantis, in that marvelous stanza that PK gives us, there is a statement, I am the one, I God. This is millions of years ago that such perceptions existed among the initiates of the time. We've gone through many descents into limiting ignorance since that time. But even then, when faced with the third degree, the realizing initiate could say, I am the one, I God, and mean it, and know it. I am the form in which all forms are merged. I am the soul in which all souls are fused. I am the life, and in that life, all little lives remain. See, this discussion that I'm undertaking is not about the details of manifestation, which are substantially derived from and one with substance. All those details of the various knowledges which we must master as we continue to live our incarnational cycles in order to manifest the divine plan as conceived by our planetary logos and beyond. So we will be the master of many items of knowledge which are needed in the process of manifesting that part of the divine ideation which is up for manifestation at a particular time and in a particular space. We will do that, and it will go on for trillions of what we call years and quadrillions and beyond, because the duration of an entire cosmos is expressed by a number, a limited number, but a number which is so large that we cannot conceive it. Well, maybe we can conceive it, but we cannot come to meaningful terms with it. So on and on, through many cycles, we will acquire knowledges, assimilate them, apply them for purposes always higher than our own in the individual sense. But what we're trying to talk about now lies behind all possible knowledges, even the greatest of all knowledges. The galactic logos has knowledges, beings that include that being merely as an aspect or a chakra, have knowledges, and even the universal logos to run the system which he has become must have knowledges. But what is of the essence? With our own puny human mind at this time, we can direct thought to such questions in the hope that by so directing, thought power will be increased, and our capacity for identification will be increased, and we will be in a position better to have deep understanding of essential matters which lie within and behind and beyond all possible knowledge, except in the sense that to know is to be, because that too is possible. That to true and truly know a thing is not only to unite with a thing in harmony and love, but to be that thing. Maybe that is the true knowing. God is. The Lord for A stands firm, never altering, pure being. What it is, only what it is, forever what it is, never changing, and yet responsible for the perpetual motion of endless change. Being exists alone. I do not exist, you do not exist, except as pure being, although we are much deluded into thinking that we as separate and distinct units of being, units of consciousness, do somehow forever exist. Our limited existence is not forever. It is for a span. Thus, the perception of our own limitation is for a span only. And this goes for planetary and solar logoi and those beyond. Pure being conceiving of itself as a planetary logos, a solar logos, a galactic logos, is only for a time. Pure being is what it is, and only what it is, and only it exists forever. Now, to have a universe, to have this universal drama, this universal play or dance, there has to be the perception of difference and of apparently separated identities. That's the only way the drama of multiplicity can be staged, when there is unitary being. There can be no dance, no play, no drama. There can only be what there is, and in which there can be no change and no contest. But forever, that which we are becomes universes for reasons that we cannot fathom, although I ridiculously attempted to say, to offer a few reasons, more in terms of logic, or that which lies beyond logic, the logic of paradox. I attempted to offer a little bit of that in my Infinity book, realizing the hopelessness of it, but, you know, still being inclined to try. In other words, that the greatest of all, to remain forever and exactly what it is, must also demonstrate as that which it is not. Now, I won't get too much into that because it's a hopeless quagmire, but it tries to reconcile changelessness with perpetual motion. The first two formulations, or what are they called? Postulates of the secret doctrine, principles of the secret doctrine, that there is a boundless, immutable principle, immutable, and yet, number two, that there is perpetual change through periodicity. So, whoever can reconcile immutability with perpetual change, for that person, for that intelligence, some wisdom has dawned, because that type of reconciliation seems like the most unbridgeable contradiction. But, you know, thinking about these things is one thing. It leads to participation in them. And it is through participation that we gain the real understanding. In other words, can there be ever in-depth understanding without identification, without standing under as substance? See, understanding and sub, under and sub are the same. Understanding, substance. Being substance is understanding. So we're really asking here were kind of a ontological exercise. An ontological act. An act which establishes the reality of being, not just through the mind, but through participation. God is the Lord for A stands firm, and that means I for A stand firm. I, the big I. I used to draw that as kind of like a, you know, an I in bold with quotes around it. No good. I have to get back to my infinity book and change every one of those bolded I's. Because now what I do is I take a great big O, much bigger than all the rest of the letters. I bold it and I put that one in quotation marks, single quotes. Of course, as Manly Hall wisely wrote, I'll just paraphrase, if we're going to deal with space, we might as well have a blank page. I think he begins with a blank page. He can't really symbolize it, you know, except by nothing. So, you know, maybe I should leave a space every time I run into the reference of that beingness, that pure being in my book. But anyway, I think big O, you know, big cipher is better than the I, which still implies duality of some kind. Then when I want to write about that pure O in universe, I write the figure eight. It's kind of infinity in action. Infinitude not in action. It's this. Infinitude descending and reascending. That's the eight. I use that as the I. But I for A stand firm, not the tiny egoistic I revealed to the concrete mind, but an I that is unfathomable and which can be somewhat hinted at in the idea that naught is but me. From the second stanza of those wonderful short stanzas on the seven rays. Naught is but me. And we must find ourselves as being and know that only as being do we exist alone. As many beings and existences, we apparently exist never alone, always in the company of instantiations of being. But we must also find ourselves as pure being, discover ourselves as pure being, wiping away all the forms, blotting out all the forms, hiding all the differences, as is required in Rule 5 and Rule 9 of the rays and the initiations, the more advanced rules. I'll turn to it just for, it's a little hard to find it sometimes, but in the rays initiations, let's go to about page 20 or so. That's the establishment of the new age. That's the wrong one. Okay, go to page 20. Approximately there, a little bit later. But there it is, rule 5. In unison that the group perceive the triad shining forth, dimming the light of the soul and blotting out the light of form. Dimming the light of the soul, not eradicating it completely, but dimming it and blotting out not form yet, but the light of form, which is a step occurring before blotting out all form. The macrocosmic whole is all there is. Let the group perceive that whole and then no longer use the thought, my soul and thine, a very illusory thought and one which we have to be cautious in using if we hope to approach the perception of oneness. Let's go to Rule 9. It's even more powerful. Let the group know there are no other selves. Let the group know there is no color, only light, and then let darkness take the place of light, hiding all difference, blotting out all form. Now that's more radical yet. All difference is hidden, not just the soul, which is in a way the principle of differentiation, not just the soul light being dimmed, but hiding all difference. You can't see it anymore. You cannot perceive it. Well, practically, of course, you can, but you understand it as to be no difference at all. Hiding all difference, blotting out all form. Then at the place of tension and at that darkest point, let the group see a point of clear cold fire, and in the fire right at its very heart, let the one initiator appear whose star shone forth when first the door was passed. There is debate on whether this phrase signifies the third initiation or the fifth initiation, or both. There are reasons for that, but let's just say that the one initiator is not seen face to face before the fifth initiation, but only his star is seen, even at the third initiation. Well, anyway, these are stanzas which go deeply into the matter of revealing the unity, and are coming close to the kinds of great statements that we read in the six trumpeted words. Naught else is. So I think it's very important every once in a while for us to escape from the perception of the concept of everything else, I and everything else than I. All that, everything else, even that little I, is nothing but the one pure being, than which naught else is. And to dwell in that perception to dim the light of the soul, to blot out the light of form, to hide all difference, finally, to blot out all form entirely. This is a worthy state of realization, and one which we should attempt to enter. Of course, I say we, I have to say we, you know, each one of us. I have to talk in the language as if we are separate. And that pretty well describes the state in which we find ourselves, perceiving something we think we are, and perceiving at the same time something greater, and seeking entry into an identification with and as that something greater. That would be somehow the dynamic which we are pursuing at this time, given what we are as instantiations of being deeply immersed in multiple self-perceptions. So, you know, to use the normal language is necessary here, but can we grasp that naught else is? Can we look at anything and find the one self, the one being, not only in it, but that anything as it, being none other than each variation, each of the, for us, uncountable instantiations of it, being only it? Can we, in fact, reduce form to homogeneity? Do we find it worth doing? I mean, you know, it doesn't mean we don't deal with homogeneity. We have to play our part, our isolated part, our little part. There all the honor lies, we've been told. Act well your part, there all the honor lies. But can we every once in a while, when moments of practicality are not pounding at the door, can we make our escape into homogeneity? And become successful in reducing whatever form is presented to consciousness into the irreducible homogeneity, or at least our estimation of what that is, whether we can ever perceive the irreducible homogeneity is questionable, but we can register approximations of it, ever refined approximations of it. I sometimes wonder whether the universal logos as an instantiation of that, the ultimate homogeneity, can register the ultimate homogeneity until it itself dissolves and is absorbed back into and as that homogeneity, ultimate homogeneity. This is a question which we can answer later when our identification with greater wholes is more established. God is the Lord, for A stands firm. Being exists alone. Naught else is. And shouldn't this be, in a way, the most comforting statement to the fearful, apparently isolated individuality which is ever cognizant of the possibility of its annihilation? The greatest of all existential fears, the greatest of all fears, I think, the fear of annihilation. So shouldn't this be existentially comforting, this great assertion of fact, dealing with the one and only fact? Well, you can see how we could ponder on this a long time, ever deepening our perception of these magnificent words. I felt I've spent the day today almost in a coma. Not able to deal with many matters of a more mundane circumstantial nature. But sometime later in the evening, when I went into the temple, something impressed me. I'm trying to formulate a little bit of that. The hour's late, but I hesitate to let it go. Number two, time is. Speaking of time, I'm looking at it. Time is. Being descends to manifest. Creation is. Time then and form agree. Being and time do not agree. in a few simple words, handling the great questions which have vexed thinking people, philosophers, for for how long, and on how many planets, and in how many systems? Like forever? At a certain stage of immersion, the vexation of a limited consciousness troubles the unit. And here they are dealt with very straightforwardly. But to fathom them, that's the thing. Time is. Well, is it in the same sense that God is? Well, look at the first two fundamentals of the secret doctrine. There is an unbounded, immutable principle. And then the second, that there is a law of periodicity, constant, perpetual alternation of universe, non-universe, though always being Venus is. So, is time when time is not? And the secret doctrine tells us there is a time when time is not. You see the problem there already. If we look at an endless sequence of God as all in all, and God in expression as the universe, we immediately have that type of alternation between two perceptions which creates time. The great breath breathes, maybe it is the one that breathes in, there is no universe, breathes out, there is. So by the very fact of the existence of the great breath, we have the assertion of supercosmic time. We talk sometimes glibly about time disappears and time alters, and at a certain stage of consciousness there is no time. Time is seen to be an illusion, etc., etc. But if there is a great breath, which is ultimately responsible for the appearance and disappearance of the universe, not of many universes, because many universes are all one universe anyway, depending upon the perception, the appearance and disappearance of the universe, then we have time. Anyway, time is. This asserts, and I certainly think that in a way, supercosmic time is, even though all units of time, if I can use this verb, infinitesimalize in the presence of absolute duration. So any unit of time becomes as a next to nothing in comparison with eternal duration. And that, those are wild concepts. They really take any definite span, we call them, any definite span, even a virtually endless duration, and infinitesimalize it, meaning that all spans are equal, all spans of time are equal. When compared with eternal duration, they become infinitesimals, but that sounds awfully specifiable. I'd like to call it they become infinitesimalizings, becoming ever smaller and smaller in comparison with eternal duration. So I'm willing to accept that time is. There can be variations in our perception of time, and it can seem to speed up or to slow down, and may in fact speed up or slow down. because everything's a perception anyway. I said everything is a perception. I actually mean that. It's nothing. It's not a perception. It's self-perception, as a matter of fact. But, you know, I guess I can't help but refer to my Infinity book, Infinitization, when dealing with these matters. But for a more coherent presentation, one could actually go to the book itself. And one day, I intend to revisit it and rethink it and see where the thinking can be improved. Time is, for all practical purposes and forever, there will be the great breath. And because of the alternation of states, because of that fundamental dualistic change, time will be. Although, as I say, it melts into virtual nothingness in the face of eternal duration. Every specifiable becomes an infinitesimal, infinitesimalizing. But beingness, the one being, is not a specifiable. Anything you say of it that seems to give it limitation is incorrect. Really, anything you say of it is incorrect. But, you know, given the mental equipment we have at the moment, we have to think something, say something. Maybe there'll come the time when we need to think or say nothing. And then perhaps true identification will be nearer. Time is being, and by that I assume we mean the one absolute being descends to manifest, and by doing so becomes the universal logos. Now, the universal logos also must descend to manifest. The unity which it is must merge into multiplicity, or not merge into, but divide into multiplicity. Being, either as the universal logos, which is a specifiable being, or the non-specifiable being, the beingness, the ultimate pure being, descends to manifest. What is descent? Certainly not up and down, but it is any kind of movement. Is any kind of movement at all is movement towards limitation. And any movement towards limitation is a descent, at least symbolically. It is a descent into limitation, a descent into specifiability. From the unspecifiable, there is a descent into specifiability. And that is manifestation. Manifestation is not just a low form, something concrete. It's anything. If the thinglessness, if the thinglessness becomes specifiable, a thing, then it has manifested. In other words, when the universal logos appears, that ray of the absolute, which has shot forth or flashed forth, where is forth? There's no forth, but has appeared. That is a descent. That is manifestation. The appearance of specifiability out of unspecifiability is manifestation. And that's a descent. Being descends to manifest. It's happened forever, endlessly. Was there ever a first descent, a first manifestation? Cannot be, because for every first, there is an anterior, a preceding. Forever and ever, this perpetual motion, this great breath, forever and ever, any first manifestation is unlocatable, unspecifiable, forever. If we could live in the eternal and know the self as one, well, each one of these requires a great labor. only to return to that which we always know. Living in the eternal and knowing the self as one. These are objectives for us. And they are objectives which will open up the realm of the cosmic ethers to us. Being descends to manifest as it ever has and ever will. That's what it does. According to the great breath, that's what it does. Creation is. What is creation? Not just the birds, the flowers, and the trees. It's everything that has emerged into specifiability that can become a percept, an object of consciousness. So the universal logos, in a sense, is creation, albeit as abstract as can be in this particular cosmos. And it, the unity, subdivides and subdivides, and the one becomes the many, and it's the many we usually call creation. But let's remember that, in a way, the universal logos itself, the absolute instantiated as a limited unity, is a creation. It's a becoming. Pure being has become it while remaining itself. So I suppose we could apply that old idea that having pervaded the entire universe with a fragment of myself, I remain. The I in this case being the absolute, and the fragment, the infinitesimalizing fragment, that's something which is as far from infinite infinity as possible. That universal logos is the fragment, the instantiation of pure being. Time is, being descends to manifest, creation is. With every universe, creation is. And just because we call the multiplicity creation does not mean that the great unities and number gods on the highest level of cosmos, very limited cosmos, but on its highest level, that they are not to be numbered within creation. Time, then, and form agree. The universal logos is, in a way, a specifiable and thus a form, although as utterly abstract a form as is possible in this universe. And it has its duration. It came to birth, and it will cease to be. Therefore, it agrees with time, which demands the origin and disappearance of all things. If time is to agree with any thing, well, time agrees with all things, because things have their origin and their disappearance. And so we can think of these things, even if the thing is the universal logos itself, as a form and in agreement with time. And thus it is the fate of all things, of all aspects of the multiplicity, which are all contents of consciousness, of the universal logos. These things all have their beginning and their end, and agree with time, which determines, in a way, their fate. They all have their duration in manifestation and their exit from manifestation in the particular form in which they manifested. the essence of course pervades, endures. It's getting late. Starting to mix my abstractions. Time, then, and form agree. Thus it is throughout the out-breath, the one instantiation of pure being with which we are currently dealing. Even the word currently implies time. Being, not the universal logos in this case, no, but pure being, the essence of a being is pure being, and is sometimes called being. Being and time do not agree. It's like saying time and duration do not agree. Duration, endless duration, the absolutely eternal, cannot be subdivided. It has no beginning, it has no end. And the events which apparently occur within it are all evanescences which have no inner, which have no lasting reality. Perceptions per se have no lasting reality. Everything is a perception. But the essence of the perception, the being within the perception, that has lasting reality and is lasting reality. So being is forever. And yet, perpetual motion within this endless duration of being is also forever. We cannot number the times in which there has been time. We can count how many inhalations and exhalations there have been. I mean, we can begin to count them. But we will find that they are infinite and uncountable. And so we can come to no true number of the times when time has prevailed. During the in-breath, it is as if time does not prevail. The in-breath is a restoration of unadulterated be-ness. And yet to the consciousness that can attempt to perceive all that has ever been, there has never been a time when the time of the great breath has not been. If we perceive pure being in contrast with the exhalation process, we have perpetual motion and the alternation of time in endless duration. But when it comes, that's like super cosmic time, of which I cannot disabuse my consciousness. It may not agree with absolute being, but it persists within absolute being and the endless duration of pure being.